Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, Donald Trump Jr. tweeted out the emails inviting him to that meeting with a Russian lawyer during the campaign, and the New York Times printed part of one. As the Times writes, it could not be more explicit. In it, an associate of the Trump family says Russian officials were offering the Trump campaign official documents incriminating Hillary. Quote, "This is obviously very high-level and sensitive information, but is part of Russia and its government's support for Trump." Donald Trump Jr. replied on email, "If it's what you say, I love it." Weeks later, Trump Jr. was asked on CNN about suspicions by Clinton's campaign manager that Russians were acting on his father's behalf. Here's part of his response.
Well, it just goes to show you their exact moral compass. I mean, they'll say anything to be able to win this. I mean, this is time and time again, lie after lie. You know, just, he won't say, well, I say this. We hear experts. You know, his house cat at home once said that this is what's happening with the Russians. It's disgusting.
Darren Samuelson is senior White House reporter for Politico. Darren, you've been looking at the legal and ethical implications here. We first saw these emails in the Times. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Now Donald Trump Jr. is also posting those emails on Twitter himself in an attempt that he says for full transparency. I wonder if his lawyers are suggesting that he do this, and I'm sure that a lot of people are scratching their head why you would be putting all this information out there when, in fact, it seemingly puts you in a lot of legal crosshairs right now. Certainly, the legal experts, the lawyers that I've spoken with, saying that he potentially is violating a number of federal criminal statutes, including solicitation or acceptance of anything of value from a foreign national, as well as conspiracy to defraud the United States. There are a couple of different federal codes that potentially Donald Trump Jr., by acknowledging and admitting all this stuff, is putting himself right in Robert Mueller's hands to at least further look at and potentially lead to, who knows where it'll go, but potentially to criminal charges.
Well, Robert Mueller, of course, who's leading up the FBI investigation. Look, let's remind ourselves how we got here over the last several days. At first, Donald Trump Jr. said that his meeting with this Kremlin-connected lawyer was to find out about Russian adoption policies. After the New York Times printed further stories, he admitted that he took the meeting because he'd been told that this lawyer might have some, negative research on Hillary Clinton. Then three people who were obviously close to this meeting told the New York Times that an email showed that, in fact, this was the Russian government involved. And now we have seen parts of the email showing that this was information that came from the Russian government. U.S. agencies have all concluded that the Russians interfered in the election. The ongoing investigations are to determine if the Trump campaign colluded. What are you saying? Are you saying that, this is proof of that?
What I'm saying is that this is evidence that Robert Mueller and congressional investigators, as they do their investigations and ask people questions under oath, it's going to be on Donald Trump Jr. and the other people who are at this meeting to tell the truth. What they've been slowly, dripping out in their statements to the New York Times is one thing. And you're not under oath when you talk to the New York Times or any news media outlet for that matter. You can say whatever you want. But when you're talking to someone under oath, whether it be, again, the FBI or Congress, and you give inappropriate information, if you lie, if you perjure yourself, that's where the federal charges could come into play. That is typically where a lot of big Washington scandals often, lead to people getting in a lot of trouble. What they are giving here is just a trail of evidence that will be certainly combed over very closely and very carefully. And, when you're seeking opposition research, it's one thing domestically with other people, here in the United States, but it's a whole other matter when you're potentially soliciting or engaging in opposition research when there's a foreign national involved.
Well, also appearing to lie about it. Just comment on that, because, we have now this email, we have the meeting, but then days after that, on several occasions, Donald Trump Jr. was asked about any Russian interference, and as you heard, he called it disgusting.
Sure. I mean, again, part of the defense that the Trump world, not just Donald Trump Jr., but his father and many others, is, to throw sand in the eyes of investigators and to try and avoid necessarily the direct question. So all of the denials that we've seen, whether they be from Donald Trump Jr. or the president or others, is really just kind of part of I think, one leg of the strategy, the political public face of how they're responding to these things compared to, what they might be saying when they're actually you know, sitting across from a federal agent with a tape recorder running.
You talked about a couple of things, you know, accepting something of value from a foreign agency or conspiring against the U.S. Is that the same as treason? Richard Painter, a former George W. Bush White House ethics lawyer, spoke to you. He is calling this meeting treason.
Yeah, Richard Painter is calling it treason. I believe a couple of other lawmakers have taken that next step and used the treason word. You know, you can call it what you will. There are different parts of the federal code that potentially could be used here, you know, in filing charges. That will be on Robert Mueller if he does decide to file any kinds of charges with respect to this particular aspect of, remember, a much, much, much larger investigation that's looking at everything from obstruction of justice involving the president to how did John Podesta's emails end up on WikiLeaks. So there's a lot of different moving parts here.
Darren Samuelson, senior White House reporter for Politico.
Sunday marked the 100th day of anti-government protests in Venezuela. More than 90 people have died in demonstrations against the socialist government there, which is presiding over a country experiencing economic collapse. Food and medicine are scarce, and a recent report indicates more than 80% of Venezuela's population lives in poverty. It's not just the wealthy who are escaping the misery. Now many of the country's working class and poor, once loyal to the ruling leftist revolution, are fleeing. Tim Padgett from Here and Now contributor WLRN in Miami reports.
Her name is Graylis. She arrived in South Florida 2 months ago from Los Teques, Venezuela, south of Caracas. Her story is typical of recent immigrants from Venezuela, which is suffering the world's worst economic implosion today. Graylis cries as she recalls her children watching neighbors eating food out of a dumpster. I was afraid that was going to happen to us soon, she says, because she had just lost her own job. Graylis worked for a publicity firm printing flyers, but its customers included protesters staging anti-government demonstrations. So Venezuela's socialist revolution shut the company down. Graylis says pro-government thugs came and began roughing her and other employees up. She, her husband, mother-in-law, and 2 boys left for the U.S. using tourist visas they'd gotten a few years ago. Graylis asked us not to use her last name since her asylum request is pending. They're all living in a one-bedroom apartment in Doral, a city just west of Miami, which has become America's largest Venezuelan enclave.
Hola. Aquí necesitamos muchos colaboradores.
Every Thursday, they come to Our Lady of Guadalupe Roman Catholic Church for food and other help. They and scores of other Venezuelan families. It's not unusual for South Florida churches to help migrant laborers from places like Central America. But Guadalupe has never seen a wave of struggling Venezuelan immigrants like these.
Usually they come between 200 and 250.
Fernando Bolaños heads Guadalupe's St. Vincent de Paul Society, which aids the new Venezuelan arrivals. Bolaños is Venezuelan, and as a lawyer who came here a decade ago to escape the revolution, he's typical of the earlier cohort of immigrants. Educated, affluent, self-sufficient. But most newcomers are working-class Venezuelans with few resources at all.
They are really living in poverty. They cannot pay for anything. So people risk everything to come over here.
Bolaños calls them an airborne version of the post-exile wave of Cuban balseros who came here on rafts.
They don't do it in boats, you know, like the Cubans. But you can say they are the balseros by air, okay?
They're a big reason political asylum requests by Venezuelans are at record highs. The UN says last year more than 18,000 Venezuelans sought U.S. asylum, the most from any nation in the world. In the first few months of this year, there was an almost 140% increase over the same period last year.
The revolution is in bankruptcy, doesn't create anything.
Jose Hernandez says the influx of working-class Venezuelans is vivid evidence that bankrupt revolution has failed the population it was supposed to care for most. Hernandez is a former Venezuelan diplomat who lives in Miami and publishes El Venezolano, one of the city's largest Spanish-language newspapers. He recently encountered a group of Venezuelan immigrants living out of a cheap car in a Walmart parking lot in Doral.
4 guys in the car who have contracted the gym very close to them to shower and go to work.
They've since found a small apartment, but Hernandez cites other factors besides economics. Venezuela's regime is now persecuting the working class to try to prevent them from defecting to the opposition. Before, it was mainly the middle and upper classes. As that gets worse, so may the wave of poorer immigrants.
We're going to have the Flights of Liberty that came from Cuba in the 60s.
Hernandez is referring to the Freedom Flights ferrying Cubans to the U.S. as the Cuban Revolution tightened its grip. Last year, the U.S. stopped issuing new visas for Venezuelans because of the overwhelming demand. But many working-class Venezuelans already had U.S. visas they got for tourist travel before Venezuela's economy collapsed, and they're often valid for a decade. As a result,
they arrived to U.S. legally.
Patricia Andrade heads Venezuela Awareness, another organization that aids new Venezuelan immigrants in Doral.
Before, it was like a dream of the Venezuelan to come to U.S. as a tourist, not for staying U.S., and now for leaving U.S.
Ask Angel Lopez. He and his family arrived in Doral just last month from Valencia, Venezuela, where he was a restaurant worker. A few years ago, they came to Florida for this reason. To vacation at Disney World. Now they're applying for asylum.
Nothing like a little Godsmack to get your day going. Well, now Godsmack's frontman, the four-time Grammy nominee Sully Erna, is out with a solo album, and as you'll hear, it's a little more solo Springsteen than hard rock. And one track is dedicated to people struggling with and dying from opioid addiction. The video for Different Kind of Tears starts with a montage of moms.
Losing a child is just something that it's difficult to put into words. When our children were going through addiction, at least I know for myself, I had hope. There was always hope that he would get better, that he would recover, and that life would be normal. When we lose a child, we don't just lose that child, we lose an important part of our future.
The real-life moms who've lost children are followed by a fictional story of young people struggling to stay alive. The song is Sully's. The video was produced in partnership with the Recovery Centers of America and the Mark Wahlberg Youth Foundation. We wanted to hear more. So Sully Erna joins us from the studios of NPR West in California. Hi.
Hi.
And also joining us, Rich Smith. He's with the Recovery Centers of America, and he's at WHYY in Philadelphia. Rich, welcome to you as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Sully, I want to start with you. Some of us remember your shirtless, headbanging, crowd surfing days, you know, in Godsmack. I know you have a big tour coming up. You were born in Lawrence, Mass. We can still see the bones of this once majestic mill city, but it's fallen on hard times. Governors in neighboring states, New Hampshire and Maine, have blamed Lawrence for some of the fentanyl and opioids that flow into their states. Is that part of why you're so conscious of this?
For me, it's very personal because, you know, Lawrence, Massachusetts is my hometown. I was born and raised there, spent the first two decades of my life there. And it really has become the hub of, you know, all this opioid and heroin that is going through the Northeast in general and throughout the nation. You know, Lawrence, to me, was probably my biggest challenge growing up there because it was extremely violent place, you know, and I was involved in a lot of that stuff when I was younger with gangs and drugs and crime. And, you know, I think even Time magazine quoted Lawrence as the most violent city in America at one point. For me, it was, you know, even more personal.
We spoke recently with Ken Casey of the Dropkick Murphys. Their last CD really was about the opioid epidemic. He had just come from a funeral. There had been several that week. These are not just friends, but fans. And Sully, I wonder, you know, all kinds of music kind of celebrate the rough life. But is there any part of you that now wants to say to your fan base, well, hold on, because this could kill you?
Yeah, this is the real deal. Like, this is one of those things you could just experiment and try once and not wake up from it. And we don't know, you know, what's in half of these drugs now, what they're cutting it with. And, you know, and the medical industry needs to step up a little bit, too, and do their job because, you know, these doctors, you know, prescribe you these intense opioids and stuff like that when you have, you know, a toothache. And I think that's another problem.
Let's listen to a little of your song, Different Kind of Tears.
It's a different kind of hurt. It's a different kind of lonely. It's a deeper kind of pain. Don't act like you know this, 'cause what you don't see, it's buried inside of me. All these cries always trying to disappear. These are different kind of tears.
A different kind of song, too, for someone who's the lead singer of Godsmack. But we see this young boy wandering, you know, seems just to like a billiard ball. He's just pinged, you know, from person to person that, you know, doesn't respond to him. And you show an overdose. It's really ugly.
It is. You know, it's an ugly addiction. It's an ugly drug. You know, there's nothing good about any of this stuff. And people in general need to know that, that, you know, this isn't something you want to be curious about and experiment with. It's life or death. And that's as bottom line as it can be. Mm. In the song as well, you know, this really caters to people with the addiction as well. You know, in their cry for help, they're looking to be helped. They want out of this lifestyle. All you think about is when you're going to get high next. Like it's you're just working from minute to minute, and it really takes over your life. And we're losing, I think, 60,000 people a year at this point, and it's growing.
Well, Rich Smith, let's bring you in from the Recovery Centers of America. This new report that just came out, STAT, the health publication, spoke to 10 healthcare people at 10 universities, and they projected at least 500,000 deaths from opioid overdoses in the next 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. You know, the numbers are just staggering. And I think, yeah, you spoke about the opening montage of the video that was, you know, a number of moms showing pictures of their children that have been taken by this disease. You know, it was actually shot in our new facility just outside of Boston. You know, one of the most heartbreaking scenes, I think, in the entire video is when, you know, the boy goes to his mom and convinces his mom to take him back in, and he's only there for a few minutes, long enough to steal her purse and run out the door. Mm. You know, addiction breaks families, it breaks lives, and it causes people to do things to those around them, many times the ones that they love the most, that are the most hurtful.
Mm. Well, look, do you take some comfort in the fact that in the recent battle over the Republican health care plan, two major Republican senators who said no, from Ohio and from West Virginia, objected because some of the opioid care funds would be cut in different ways by cutbacks in Medicaid. There wasn't going to be enough money for opioid treatment.
We found that this issue really is not a Republican issue or a Democrat issue. Everybody is in support and realizing the danger that we're facing if we do not deal with this crisis. This is really a bipartisan issue.
Well, the lieutenant governor of Ohio has had two sons overdose. Thankfully, they've been saved. Sully, when you were 19, 20, would you have listened to a video about any kind of lifestyle thing? I mean, do you think you can get this over?
You know, it's an interesting question because when you're there, you know, especially with the teenage years, I have a 15-year-old daughter. And luckily for me, she doesn't seem to be going down this path. Everyone has that choice. That's the thing. Whether you grow up in the inner city or whether you grow up on the better part of town. You know, I want to just interject with something Rich was saying too. You know, I want people to understand out there, especially the kids that are listening, the people that are involved in this kind of thing or entertaining the thought of dipping your toe in. This starts with you. This is your choice to not do the drug, to not be influenced by your friends and things like that. You're the one who has to know that there's a better life on the other side. Because the way that we kill this quicker and more efficiently than we could ever do by controlling government or medical industry or whatever is just to have the people not buy or be involved in doing drugs and opioids. If you want to stop this, if you want to put an end to it, A, you parents need to get more involved. Do not think that's Lawrence's problem. This isn't in Windham, New Hampshire. Well, yes, it is, because these kids are traveling around and going into Lawrence to be able to get this stuff and then bringing it back to these neighborhoods. So it's spreading everywhere.
Or Sully, going into their parents' medicine cabinets and something I learned about recently, you know, taking out all the medication, dumping them in a big bowl at a party. And it's called the candy bowl.
Exactly. Start locking up the stuff. Or better yet, start maybe thinking about how you don't have to have that in your house available.
And on the issue of choice, there's also the choice to get treatment. You know, one of the very common paths to addiction is seemingly innocent. You know, you can go in for surgery and be prescribed opioids and, you know, basically due to your own genetics, become addicted very, very quickly. And it just escalates, you know. The prescription opioids go to trying to buy them on the street, but that gets too expensive, and then it quickly downward spirals into, you know, $5 bags of heroin.
Sully, are you going to deliver this message from the stage?
Of course. I mean, you know, this is, you know, the song is very, very connected to this specific epidemic and subject that we've been talking about. And so for me, not only is it going to be a message, but, it, you know, it's I'm going to even try to come up with some more conceptual footage that really hits home. I got to tell you, when I first got back in tune with Jim Wahlberg and I went to one of his events that he was hosting at an arena.
This is the Mark Wahlberg Foundation.
Correct.
Yeah.
It literally took my breath away. I had no idea what I was walking into. He said, hey, just come down, check out the event. And so I walked in and the arena was completely full. I looked to my left and the loge seat that went from the, you know, the floor all the way up to the balcony was just men and women sitting there stone-faced holding a picture of their child. And it just literally sent chills up my spine. And I started thinking, oh my God, is this whole arena filled with parents that have lost their children? And then I realized that it was this one major section. The rest of the arena, they had filled up with high schools and elementary schools that they had brought in kids to watch and learn from it.
Well, it strikes me, you know, one of your thoughts might have been, and it's not even a Godsmack concert, you know, when you can now fill an arena with parents of children who've died of overdoses and kids there to maybe learn from them. That I think that speaks volumes. That's Sully Erna of Godsmack. His new solo album, Hometown Life, includes the single Different Kind of Tears. It focuses on opioid addiction. There's a video. We'll link you to it here and now.org. And we also spoke with Rich Smith from the Recovery Centers of America. They partnered with Sully and the Mark Wahlberg Foundation to produce the song. Sully, Rich, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Ooh, it's a different kind of hurt.
More at hearnow.org.
Online security is obviously critically important. In the world of banking, for example, personal banking has become a bit more secure. Those little chips in your credit and debit cards, for example. But passwords and PIN codes are still easily hackable. So what if banks used biometrics? Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us with more. Hey.
Hi, Megan. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Now, I understand that Citibank, for example, has recently attempted to come up with more secure logins for ATMs, but that hasn't quite panned out, even though they tried to use biometric data. So what hasn't worked so far?
All right. Well, so WSJ's Telos Deimos reports that back in 2015, Citigroup began testing this system that would scan a customer's iris and then make a four-digit access code obsolete that way. But 2 years later, they've shelved that project. And the reason is that it just became so costly and complex to collect and manage millions of customers' biometric data. And, you know, they had this large database that they were worried that could be, you know, a really juicy target for hackers. So the new approach that they're taking and other banks are taking, it relies on customers to store and safeguard biometric data themselves on their smartphones.
On their phones. Okay. And
yes.
I mean, this is actually
one more task for our smartphones.
I know. But it's something that smartphones, you know, millions and millions and millions of them are already doing, right? I mean, you stick your finger on the little pad, your thumb, and it unlocks your phone.
Right. And, you know, you can do a lot of online banking. I'm with Wells Fargo, and my online bank relies on using my thumbprint. The rumors we're hearing about the new iPhone that's coming out is that it's going to have even more biometric capabilities when that comes out in September, eagerly awaited. But over the past year, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Bank of America, they've all been rolling out new ATMs that are able to link to your mobile device. So you sign in through your phone using a fingerprint, and that transmits a code over to the ATM.
So my first and perhaps most obvious question, Jason, is what if you lose your phone or you don't have it with you, shockingly, when you need to get cash from the ATM?
Well, the short answer is you'd be pretty out of luck. So that's definitely one of the considerations here. You know, what number do you call? How do you make a call if you've already lost your phone? And that's potentially a real problem. You just would not be able to access that machine. And so you'd have to find a way separately to reach your bank. And yeah, that definitely is a concern. And there's no easy solution to that at the moment.
So why is it that banks are doing this specifically with ATMs? Are they insecure? I mean, I've heard of people like hacking the ATMs or doing sort of like key reader hacks on them. But is this a huge problem?
Yeah. I mean, it really is that fraud is rising. And that's despite all these new security measures, such as, you know, the chip-enabled cards that you probably already have in your wallet. They've detected, according to one credit data provider, a 70% uptick in compromised cards that are being used in ATMs and merchants last year. And so this new approach really shifts the security burden to you, the user, and how you use your phone. So you've got to protect your phone from being imitated or hacked. You've really got to be conscious of your phone's security measures. So onus is on you more so than the bank that issues you the card.
All right, so the onus will be on us. But I'm just going to presume that these multi-billion dollar institutions are still going to try to do their best to be secure on their end. Jason Bellini of the Wall Street Journal, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
So where are we? Last night, the New York Times, quoting anonymous sources, wrote that Donald Trump Jr. had been told in an email that the information he was going to get from a Russian lawyer about Hillary Clinton was part of the Russian government's efforts to help his father's campaign. Then this morning, Trump Jr. himself tweeted screenshots of the email chain in question just minutes before the Times published parts of one email online. It's pretty straightforward. It says the information on Clinton was, quote, obviously very high level and sensitive information, but is part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump. And Donald Trump Jr.'s reply, if it's what you say, I love it, especially later in the summer. Well, who wrote that email? And who are the other players in this unfolding drama? Tom Hamburger of The Washington Post is here to introduce this cast of characters. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Robin.
So these emails that Donald Trump Jr. tweeted out today are from Rob Goldstone. He's a former British tabloid journalist. He's now a music producer, and he's a publicist. And that's how he knows the Trumps?
Yes. It was the cast of characters is in some ways quite extraordinary here. Rob Goldstone is a publicist and kind of music industry consultant based in Britain who got to know Donald Trump Jr. when he assisted in the licensing of the Miss Universe pageant and its pageant display in 2013, its pageant offering 2013 in Moscow. And since then, the two have remained friends, and there is a third party that connects them, a guy called Iman Agalarov, who is a self-described pop star dancer who also happens to be represented by Mr. Goldstone. And the Agalarovs are the family that paid to have the Miss Universe pageant brought to Moscow and have discussed and made preliminary plans to do other deals with the Trumps.
Well, tell us more about the Agalarovs as a family, because that brings in Aras Agalarov, who is Iman Agalarov's father. They own something called the Crocus Group, a real estate development company in Russia. As you said, they were licensed to sponsor the Miss Universe pageant in Russia in 2013, became friendly with the Trumps then. They are a pretty powerful family in Russia.
Yes. They are originally from Azerbaijan, moved to Moscow, and have become prominent developers and contractors. That is Aras Agalarov, the father. He is also said to be close to Vladimir Putin. And after the 2013 Miss Universe pageant, received a special award of honor of the Russian Federation, pinned on his chest by Vladimir Putin. And we know from interviews that my colleagues at that the Washington Post had with the Agalarov's father and son, that it was Aras Agalarov who was trying to arrange an actual face-to-face meeting at the time in 2013 between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. Trump was very much interested in meeting Putin, but something came up at the last minute. The meeting was canceled, but Putin delivered to Agalarov a special a gift and a note, personal note to Donald Trump apologizing for not meeting in person.
So the families have these social interactions in Russia. Donald Trump had tweeted out that he was hoping to meet Putin through this family. They have this relationship through the Miss Universe pageant. They almost built a Donald Trump tower together because of the real estate development company that the Agalarovs own. But that project was stopped when Donald Trump started running for president. But one of the threads in the fabric that's woven between these two families is pretty amazing. And we just want to hear a little bit of it. Emin, as you said, is a kind of a self-described pop star. And Donald Trump appears in one of Emin's music videos. Now, we want to hear a little bit of the video. It's quite long. But what you see initially is Emin wandering through a luxury apartment, sort of woe is me, draping himself over pianos and such. Then beautiful women begin to show up. And look, they're Miss Universe contestants. And then suddenly at a desk is Donald Trump because Emin's actually been in a dream. Let's hear a little.
Wake him up right now. Emin, wake up. Come on. What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you, Emin? Emin, let's get with it. You're always late. You're just another pretty face. I'm really tired of you. You're fired.
Okay. So, Tom Hamburger, I mean, just something, you know, worth noting, that these families became close.
The families became close. They met originally, according to our interviews with the Agalarovs, earlier before the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow at a Trump hotel in Las Vegas. And Emin was hoping to have Donald Trump appear in the music video, which in fact was filmed in Moscow in 2013 at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. And they did it in one take. There were Miss Universe candidates who were part of the cast. And then, of course, as your audio just played, Donald Trump is heard and he's visible in the screen version saying, "You're fired."
Well, now that we know the players, we want to look again at the email from Rob Goldstone, again, the publicist, that was sent to Donald Trump Jr. that was printed in part today by The New York Times and streamed out, tweeted out by Donald Trump Jr., part of an email stream. This particular email is from June 3rd, 2016. He writes, "Good morning. Emin," again, this is the son, the rock star, "just called and asked me to contact you with something very interesting. The Crown Prosecutor of Russia met with his father, Aras, this morning, and in their meeting, offered to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. This is obviously very high-level and sensitive information, but is part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump, helped along by Aras and Emin," again, the father and son. And again, Rob Goldstone writes to Donald Trump Jr., "What do you think is the best way to handle this information? Would you be able to speak to Emin about it directly? I can also send this info to your father via Rona." Rona, we believe, is a staffer. "But it is ultra-sensitive, so wanted to send to you first. Best, Rob Goldstone." And that's when Donald Trump Jr. replies, "If what you say is true, I love it. I just will speak to Emin first." Look, from what you know, Tom Hamburger, about the family, the Agalarovs, does it ring true that they would have access to that kind of high-level Russian documents and information?
Well, there are a couple of things I think we want to point out here. The meeting and the role of the Agalarovs is significant for two reasons. One, it suggests an economic and a financial tie to the Trump family, which is real. The one Donald Trump likes to say, "I've not invested in Russia," but in fact, Russians have invested in him, and one of the best-known deals was the Agalarov licensing of the Miss Universe pageant. The second significant part of it is that the Agalarovs are a family of politically connected, close to the Kremlin, and so you have here not only a tie to Donald Trump financially, but you have a tie to Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin through this family of oligarchs oligarchs, the Agalarovs, who are friendly with Putin and are known to him. So it is significant that that they arranged this meeting or requested it, at least according to the Goldstone emails. Goldstone said that they were bringing in a top prosecutor. In fact, the lawyer who appeared, Natalia Veselnitskaya, was once a prosecutor in Russia, though she has since become a private sector lawyer and consultant, also very well connected, and has campaigned in the U.S. and elsewhere against sanctions against Russia that were imposed by the United States.
Yeah. She's referred to in the emails. Rob Goldstone calls her the Russian government attorney. Russia is denying that she is now a government attorney. But look, is it possible, Tom Hamburger, that all of this could be the bloviating of a publicist trying to impress the new president of America?
I would say that it's possible, but we have some circumstances which are really quite astounding here.
And briefly.
Okay. One is, I just remind you that Donald Trump Jr., the guy who helped arrange the meeting and wrote Love It back to the publicist when he was told about this Russian, Russian government offer of help, said in July
He said he denied that the Russians had contacted him. Tom Hamburger.
Yes, and now he's acknowledging it.
Yep. Tom, thanks.
You bet.
Well, that's sound from a rather bizarre video that purports to show Chinese and Indian soldiers scuffling on a barren landscape in the Himalayas. It's part of a border dispute between India and China that also involves the tiny Buddhist kingdom of Bhutan. The BBC's Justin Rowlatt is following the story. He joins us from Delhi. And Justin, first of all, tell us exactly where this is happening. It looks like a moonscape, rather.
It is. It's an extraordinary, tiny little Himalayan plateau, about 3,000 metres up. And it's on a sliver of land between the Indian state of Sikkim, which is in the northeast of India, and, as you say, the tiny Buddhist kingdom of Bhutan. So it's and the actual plateau that we're talking about is 6 kilometres long and 10 kilometres wide. So absolutely tiny. The only people who ever go there, apart from Indian and Chinese soldiers, are Bhutanese yak herders. And yet this has become a really important battleground. Not battleground's too strong, but a focus for tensions between these two giant nuclear powers, India and China, who, as you say, are standing off. And let's just tell the audience a little bit about the video. You've seen the video, have you, Magda?
Yes, yes.
So you see these soldiers. You can't actually see, I don't think they've got any weapons on them. And essentially they're sort of, how would you describe it? They're sort of pushing each other.
Yeah, I mean, a scuffle is sort of the word that comes to mind, which is so weird.
They sort of bump chests and push each other and shout a bit at each other and then push each other back, as if they're trying to push each other over a line without actually punching or kicking or hitting or shooting each other. And I suppose in a way that's what they are trying to do, because this is a territorial dispute. It's actually between China and Bhutan, but the Indians have got involved because, as I say, it's so close to the border with India that they say it has strategic import for them, and they're very close allies with Bhutan, who they say invited them in. So the issue is that the Chinese wanted to build a road, and the Indians are worried. They've got the sort of strategic advantage. They're on the high ground at the moment, and this would kind of tilt the balance more back towards China a bit. So they're worried that strategically this is a threat to India. India and China have a massive border, more than 2,000 kilometres long, and this is the longest standoff since the Indo-Chinese War. It sounds very technical, but there was a war between India and China over another bit of border in 1962. So, you know, tensions really are beginning to build.
Well, I mean, it's important that you note that India and China have been at war before, because, I mean, at least for now, there's this chest-bumping scuffle going on. But are there concerns that this could escalate and become an actual military confrontation?
Everybody seems to think this will be resolved peaceably. They're not saying that this is going to be a war, but everybody's beginning to say, my goodness, this is taking a long time to resolve, and that is a bit worrying. And it comes at a time when there are deepening tensions between the two countries already.
So tell us more about that, because, I mean, as you said a little earlier, these are two giant powers who are constantly jockeying for, you know, preeminence in the region, let alone in China's case, in the world.
The Chinese, as you may have reported before, are beginning the biggest infrastructure investment in the history of the world. They want to build something called the Belt and Road, which is this huge project to link up Asia, Europe, Africa, you know, basically link up the world. It involves a huge road and rail building project across the south of China, right across Central Asia and into Europe. So they're building, that's actually bizarrely the belt bit. The road is a network of ports which are going to link up the China to the rest of the world, to Africa, through the Indian Ocean. And they involve ports in all sorts of neighbours of India that it considers its kind of natural kind of territory, if you like. So they call it the String of Pearls. And they see themselves as being encircled by China. So they're feeling quite threatened by China at the moment, which is perhaps one reason why they're being so kind of determined not to stand down in this dispute. And the rhetoric has got quite kind of heated, you know. India has said, you know, where the Indian army chief has said, we're fully ready for war. But the Chinese army said India must remember the lessons from history. And I think it was referring back then to the 1962 war that we've already mentioned. So the rhetoric's quite tense, and it comes at a time of underlying tension. So whilst, you know, no one's thinking, as I say, that they're going to go to war, people are beginning to kind of wonder what the kind of passageway to a resolution is going to be, given the kind of rhetoric we're beginning to hear.
So, I mean, obviously we've been focused on the behemoth, as you say, of the region. But I'm curious, what are the Bhutanese saying about all of this?
They're anxious that if the Chinese get this toehold in the Doklam Plateau, the plateau that we're talking about, then the Chinese will be able to have their artillery will be able to close the main road into the capital of Bhutan. So they're very anxious about it. And their natural tendency is to ally with India. But significantly, there was a big conference that China held in Beijing in May for this Belt and Road project, and neither India or Bhutan turned up. And the Chinese at the time, it was clear that they reckoned that was a bit of a snub to this huge project that they've got going. So it looks like India and Bhutan together standing off against China. And at the moment, certainly, everybody thinks that Bhutan will stick with the Indian kind of strategy on this.
The BBC's Justin Rowell out there speaking with us from Delhi. Justin, many thanks.
Many thanks. Good to speak to you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.